Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with William Fink, with another installment of Christogenos. We're here this evening to continue our series on the study of Jeremiah. And last week, we finished Jeremiah chapter 8. Bill, do you have any summary or comments that we need to address before going into chapter 9?
Well, just a few short ones. You know, Jeremiah's indictment against the remnant of Judah continues to unfold. And this is, as we've seen in the series on Ezekiel, which really stood out, and in the epistles of John, this is a sinful nation, and therefore sinners have no recourse in prayer to God. Repentance must come first. Jerusalem won't repent, and Yahweh is promising them destruction here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Over the coming chapters, we'll see that Judah is constantly warned and chastised by Yahweh through the prophet up to the point where the promise of permanent destruction of the city is made in chapter 19. And that destruction is a forever destruction. And we can't imagine Jerusalem today to be any semblance of the true Jerusalem of Yahweh, right, which is somewhere else. Well, we also see the occasional admonition given to the whole of Israel, even though they may have been taken away already by the Assyrians, and therefore we see that they are never really out of the thoughts of Yahweh or the scope of his will on the earth. These admonitions will build up to the promise of a permanent destruction of Jerusalem, but also a promise of a new covenant and of a restoration of Judah and Israel to Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just my basic summary of what we've seen so far and what we're about to see.
Yes. So we see both, actually, Ezekiel and Jeremiah, I think, have the strongest denunciations of Israel and Judah. Okay. Isaiah gets into it a little bit, and Daniel a little bit, but both Ezekiel and Jeremiah waste no words in expressing their displeasure with disobedient Israelites, okay? And that's a heavy focus of both of these books. And in all cases, it is deserved by the children of Israel for their backsliding and disobedience. Okay, so let's go into chapter 9, verse 1. Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people.
That phrase, the daughter of my people, that refers to Jerusalem, the city.
Okay.
And the word, it appears throughout the prophets and the other books spoken of colonies or a settlement of his people is often called the daughter of my people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, question in the chat room. I'm not sure which verse is being referenced here in Jeremiah. Doesn't God tell Jeremiah not to marry? What do you call that verse and what that means? I don't think we've gotten to that yet in Jeremiah. I don't recall that.
Well, the word marry doesn't appear in Jeremiah, and neither does the word marriage, so I have no idea what he's talking about.
Okay, all right, so maybe we'll run a call. Maybe he's thinking about a different, it might be, the name of the prophet escapes me. It's not one of the major prophets, one of the minor prophets.
Hosea was told to take a whore as a wife,
right,
to represent Israel the whore, and
right.
Now he was married
exactly.
To, right?
Yeah. Okay. I don't want people cussing each other out. I'm just going to immediately mute anybody who does so. Okay. I'm just not going to stand for it. Okay. Verse 2. Oh, that I had in the wilderness a lodging place of wayfaring men, that I might leave my people and go from them, for they be all adulterers and assembly of treacherous men.
And Yahweh is saying here that he has no refuge,
right.
You know, depicting himself in human terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he certainly doesn't have any refuge in us, that's for sure. And they bend their tongues like their bow for lies, but they are not valiant for the truth upon the earth, for they proceed from evil to evil, and they know not me, says Yahweh. Take you heed, everyone, of his neighbor, and trust you not in any brother, for every brother will utterly supplant, and every neighbor will walk with slanders. Okay.
Now that word supplant, right? That's a 61:17, a cob, and it's a word with a wide range of meaning.
Uh-huh.
It may also mean to overreach or to circumvent. And circumvent seems to be the most likely, most appropriate meaning in this context,
mm-hmm.
since it seems to me like the law is what is meant, or justice, that everyone will circumvent justice.
Yes, right. Okay. And verse 5, and they will deceive everyone his neighbor and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies and weary themselves to commit iniquity. It's interesting. It reminds me of Friedrich Nietzsche's comment about the British Empire when the Germans and the British were having, beginning to have their major disputes, which ultimately resulted in World War I. He said that the biggest export of the British Empire is cant, by which he meant hypocritical speech, right? And and it's funny that the British today actually think that the British Empire has been honorable and just toward other peoples, right? When they backstabbed the Boers, they backstabbed the Chinese, they backstabbed the Indians, and whoever else they came in contact with, the Russians. Backstabbed the Russians.
And they backstabbed the Chinese. They betrayed everybody.
That's right.
And they were nefarious with everybody. And that they basically forced their trade and a trade monopoly on the whole world.
Yeah, by military force.
Yes. Yeah. And it was all an empire propped up on behalf of the merchants, the Jewish merchants of London.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right, okay, so Joel references the verse. It's Jeremiah 16:2. Thou shalt not take thee a wife, neither shalt thou have sons or daughters in this place. Okay, so that sounds like it's talking about the expulsion of the Judahites from Babylon, from Jerusalem to Babylon. So that's probably what that means, yeah. But, we can cover that in greater detail when we get there. Okay.
I would rather cover all of Jeremiah as we get there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because I haven't had a chance to look at that yet either. Okay, verse 6, your habitation is in the midst of deceit. Through deceit they refuse to know me, says Yahweh. And, of course, that's still true today. Therefore, thus says Yahweh of hosts, behold, I will melt them, I will try them, for how shall I do for the daughter of my people? And, of course, we're talking about refining us in the fire.
Yeah, that word melt is 6884 seraph. It means to refine
okay.
in the sense of smelting.
Right. Very good. Verse 8, their tongue is as an arrow shot out. It speaks deceit. One speaks peaceably to his neighbor with his mouth, but in heart he lays his weight. Another, it's very obvious to me, Bill, that when our people fall into this habit, of being deceitful, it's usually because Jews have taken control of our society, right? And they have taught us to be hypocrites. And they have
look at the world today. Look at who's teaching people to be hypocrites today. Compare society and the way it's changed over the last 100 years with what we see all the time in the television and the media.
That's right.
The media is not a reflection of society. The media is the bridle. It's the bit in the mouth of society in this country.
Yeah, and people repeat these slogans they hear on TV as if there's actually a point in watching television.
Right, and it's not only slogans, but it's all of their moral values. They mimic what they see on television.
Right, that's right. Yeah, it's the image of the beast. Verse 9, shall I not visit them for these things? Says Yahweh, shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? For the mountains will I take up a weeping and a wailing, and for the habitations of the wilderness a lamentation, because they are burned up so that none can pass through them, neither can men hear the voice of the cattle. Both the fowl of the heavens and the beast are fled. They are gone. In other words, there's going to be a total judgment here.
And he's still talking about 40 years out.
Right. And I will make Jerusalem heaps and a den of dragons, and I will make the cities of Judah desolate without an inhabitant. Who is the wise man that may understand this? And who is he to whom the mouth of Yahweh has spoken that he may declare it? for what the land, for what the land perish and is burned up like a wilderness that none passes through. And of course, this judgment, he's talking about the judgment of Jerusalem and of course of Judah. But all of this is going to repeat itself in the end times when we're going to see civilization is going to be a pile of heaps.
Because history repeats itself.
Right.
And history repeats itself because we don't learn the lessons from the first time, right?
That's right. That's right. We keep making the same mistakes. Verse 13.
It's Jeremiah chapter 19 that we'll see the most damning condemnation of Jerusalem.
Okay. All right. Verse 13, and Yahweh says, because they have forsaken my law, which I set before them, and have not obeyed my voice, neither walked therein, but have walked after the imagination of their own heart and after Balaam, which their fathers taught them. Verse 15, therefore thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will feed them, even this people, with wormwood and give them water of gall to drink.
Well, even Christ says, if you love me, keep my commandments. Nothing's changed from the Old Testament to the New.
Yes, and our judgment is continuing apace, right? Okay. All right, verse 16. I will scatter them also among the heathen, whom neither they nor their fathers have known, and I will send a sword after them till I have consumed them. And of course,
now, in the Genesis, in the biblical context, That word heathen first is nations, right?
Right.
It's the same word that's translated nations by the King James Version elsewhere in this very chapter.
Right.
And it's goyim, it's plural, right? But it's nations. I will scatter them among the nations, which in context has to be the other Genesis 10 Adamic nations.
Mm-hmm.
And in history, we see the children of Israel scattered amongst the Medes, the Assyrians, and the Elam, the Persians, primarily those three nations, and that they're all other Israelite nations. Right? I'm sorry, other Adamic Genesis 10 nations.
Right, Adamic, yeah. Okay.
It's not like they're being scattered amongst racial aliens or anything like that.
Right, right. And, you know, knowing the history, that's the case. And, yeah, the King James is fairly, not flippant, but inconsistent in its use of the word heathen, you know, in translating goy as heathen rather than nations, and there's really no rhyme or reason for why they do that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I'm guilty of translating the word ethnos as heathen in certain contexts.
Yeah.
But those contexts are where it means, well, where it should be probably more properly translated as people, which it may also be translated.
Right.
But when those people are distinctly opposed to the Christian message, not regardless of race, because it's not a racial designation in that sense of the word.
Sure.
So regardless of race, it's heathen when it should be used to describe people opposed to the Christian message.
People is a better translation than heathen. And they're very arbitrary. That's the word I was looking for. They're arbitrary in how they use the word heathen to translate the word goy.
And very often it should simply be nations, and it would make perfect sense in context.
Exactly. Okay, verse 17. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, consider you and call for the mourning women, that they may come, and send for cunning women or skilled women, that they may come, and let them make haste and take up a wailing for us, that our eyes may run down with tears and our eyelids gush out with waters. Of course, we have to be repentant for that to happen.
Well, right. And this is also a reference to the custom, in which was throughout the Near East, to hire professional mourning women for funerals.
That's right.
That they were wailing women, or they're referenced in the New Testament. And Josephus mentioned them, and the Greek writers also. And the Greek writers call them Scythian wailing women. And Scythia was evidently a place in Persia, which also employed these women, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. And the Muslims still do that
today. They got paid to mourn at funerals.
Yeah, and the Middle East and Eastern Europe, they still have that tradition, too. They just get the women to line up and wail, right? Whether they're relatives of the family or not, right? It's a kind of a traditional thing, yeah. I don't know whether they pay them for that, but
it seems to me in the ancient world there were certain women that actually got paid to mourn at people's funerals.
Right, right, yeah, very good. Okay, verse 19. For a voice of wailing is heard out of Zion. How are we spoiled? We are greatly confounded because we have forsaken the land, because our dwellings have cast us out. Yet hear the word of Yahweh, O you women, and let your ear receive the word of his mouth, and teach your daughters wailing, and everyone her neighbor lamentation. It's almost like Yahweh here is not baiting the Israelites, but saying, you know, you are professional wailers, so why don't you wail with sincerity, right? Verse 21.
Well, I think he's really telling them that they're going to need professional wailers.
Yeah, right.
Because they're about to run into some very hard times.
Right.
That they have, yeah, you know, they're a very sinful nation, and a sinful nation knows no wailing, right?
Right.
Everybody
counts.
They don't
care. Yes.
And only cares about their own bellies and their own lasciviousness and their own lewd behavior.
Right.
So what, who stops to mourn a sinful city? Just look at New York or Chicago, right?
Yeah.
or right. Las Vegas. That the but he's telling them that they're going to need these mourning women because the party's about to end.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and the party has ended for Lynn Stench too. you can get lost, Lynn Stench. Okay. Verse 21, for death has come up into our windows and has entered into our palaces to cut off the children from without and the young man from the streets. Speak, thus says Yahweh, even the carcasses of men shall fall as dung upon the open field and as a handful after the harvestmen, and none shall gather them. Thus says Yahweh, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might, let not the rich man glory in his riches. And obviously everybody is very arrogant here. Verse 24, but let him that glories glory in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am Yahweh, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness. You know, and it's quite incredible that the modern Judeo-Christians can't perceive that Yahweh's judgment is deserved. You know, they'll read a verse like this, I am Yahweh, which exercise loving kindness and righteousness, but they say, well, he doesn't punish, he doesn't judge us. Of course he does.
Well, right, when the judgment is righteous.
Yes.
Well, when we violate the law, and I have some notes on this somewhere tonight, but when we violate the law, we deserve to be judged.
That's right.
It's basically that simple. We're told in the law that there are consequences to disobedience.
That's right.
We're told what those consequences would be.
Yes, yes.
And if we're disobedient, isn't it righteous that we receive the consequences of our disobedience?
Exactly. Why would he save the unrighteous and that they get the same salvation that those who've been trying to obey the law?
Well, if somebody steals your car or does something bad to you and has to go to prison for 5 years, and everybody thinks, well, that sucks. He has to go to prison for 5 years. Well, but it's righteous because he's paying the penalty for his crime. That's the way it is. And it's the same with the nation. That the nation was disobedient, so they paid the penalty for their crime. The penalty, they were told ahead of time what it would be.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just like any other law. When you break it, God's law, of course, is it's different in this manner from man's law. It will be executed,
mm-hmm.
and it will be executed fairly and righteously.
That's right.
Even if men think it's evil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this let him the glorious glory in this. That word is halal, but colloquially, metaphorically, it means to boast.
Okay, yes.
And it really literally means to shine, but it means to boast or to vaunt oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul quotes this several times where he says, let him that boast in Yahweh.
Right, right, exactly. Very good. And these things I delight, that is in loving kindness, righteousness, and proper and justice. Justice and righteousness. Verse 25. Behold, the days come, says Yahweh, that I will punish all them which are circumcised with the uncircumcised, Egypt and Judah. And now, of course, this can only refer to Israelites, because only the Israelites had the law. And,
well, right, but it's the surrounding nations, as we saw in Ezekiel and all his oracles against them, that by which in Israel was enticed into sin, but were punished along with Israel.
Yes, yes. Oh, yeah. Other nations get punished. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, they all get punished anyhow, no matter what their ethnic origin. Especially in regard to how they treat Israel, right?
Well, right. Well, the Edomites and the Moabites and the Egyptians and the Ammonites, they all enticed Israel into sin through their own foul, disgusting Canaanite rituals and practices and false religions. So Yahweh had promised them punishment also.
Mm-hmm.
And the Assyrians and the Babylonians were used by Yahweh, and this was very clear in Isaiah when we did it, right? That they were used by Yahweh to chastise Israel, but then because they vaunted themselves that they did this by their own hand and had that arrogance and that the Assyrian kings and the Babylonian kings actually believed that they were God and they could conquer the whole world at their own will. For that reason, for their haughtiness, they were in turn, even though they were used to chastise Israel, they were in turn punished by Yahweh.
Yeah. Yeah, he was killing two birds with one stone.
Basically, yes.
Yes, yes. Okay. Verse 26, Egypt and Judah and Edom and the children of Ammon and Moab and all that are in the utmost corners that dwell in the wilderness, for all these nations are uncircumcised, and all the house of Israel are uncircumcised in the heart. And of course, we know that the 10 tribes, and actually the 12 tribes that became the uncircumcision that Paul refers to, are those primarily those uncircumcision. Certainly in the New Testament, that's who Paul is referring to, no doubt about
that. And Paul appealed to them time and again to circumcise their hearts.
Right.
He understood this prophecy in relationship to Israel. And, of course, he was only talking to the dispersion of Israel.
That's right. That's right. Okay, chapter 10. We're in Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 1. Hear you the word which Yahweh speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says Yahweh, learn not the way of the heathen. Now here's the heathen again, although in this context it would seem to be a fair translation, because obviously the other nations did not have Yahweh's law. And be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them, for the customs of the people are vain. For one cuts a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold, tinsel, right? They fasten it with nails and with hammers that it move not. You got your base for the Christmas tree. They are upright as the palm tree, but speak not. They must needs be borne or carried because they cannot go. Of course, dead idols don't have the ability of mobility.
Well, right. That's exactly it. It should really be translated because they need to be carried because they cannot walk on their own.
Yes, yes. Yes, so we're continuing here. And at this point, I have some commentaries we were talking about by Willie Martin, but let me finish verse 5.
Well, actually, it's talking about the same subject all the way through verse 8, right?
Okay.
And actually through verse 9, it's talking, and it doesn't seem like it, but it is. It's the same topic right through verse 9.
Yes. Okay, verse 5 again. And they are upright as the palm tree, but speak not. They must needs be born, because they cannot go. Be not afraid of them, for they cannot do evil. Neither also is it in them to do good. So obviously the Judahites were engaging in these rituals, and some of it was worshiping trees, right?
Well, right. Well, this is unequivocally talking about a custom which is exactly like the Christmas tree custom, which we see today, but this is 600 years before Christ.
Yes.
And I don't care how anyone wants to justify it. As innocuous, yet, you know, a lot of people say, oh, the Christmas tree is harmless. It really doesn't mean anything. It's only pretty. But this shows, nevertheless, that the so-called Christmas tree is seen by Yahweh as nothing but an idol.
Right.
They can't do evil, but wasting our time and money
yes.
to set up something so transient
mm-hmm.
and that's held in awe and wonder is at best it's vain.
Right.
But it's really a form of idolatry, and that's exactly how Yahweh says here that he sees this custom.
Right, right. Yeah, and verse 2 says we're not supposed to learn their traditions and do the things they do.
But we've done it,
yeah,
and the fact that the German people have that Christmas tree proves that they're the children of Israel, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, right, yes, exactly. Verse 6, for as much as there is none like to you, O Yahweh, you are great, and your name is great in might. Who would not fear you, O King of Nations, for to you does it appertain? For as much as among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdoms there is none like to you, and of course that's the attitude we're supposed to have, but they are altogether brutish and foolish. The stock is a doctrine of vanities.
Now here the stock, right? That word is tree.
Okay.
It's referring to the tree in the prior verses, right?
Right.
It's the same. The topic has not changed.
Okay. Now here, Willie, we're talking about this commentary by Willie Martin earlier, and it's actually a very good commentary on these passages, on this passage of Jeremiah. It's two pages I have here. I'm only going to quote three or four paragraphs. Since Christ was not born on December 25th, then how did this particular day come to be a part of the church calendar? History has the answer. Instead of this day being the time of our Savior's birth, it was the very day and season on which the pagans for centuries had celebrated the birth of the sun god, S-U-N god, of course. A study into this shows how far apostate church leaders went in their efforts to merge Christianity and paganism into one apostate religion. And, of course, we know that when Constantine issued the decree of toleration, the Edict of Toleration, what actually happened was that Christianity stopped flourishing at that point, because by merging it with paganism, it totally changed the character of Christianity. And what they did was they blended pagan rituals with whatever existing Christian rituals were extant at the time, and it actually destroyed Christianity.
Well, let me say that, you know, you could search the work of the anti-Nicene church writers, right?
Okay.
The church writers, or they're called church fathers by mainstream historians.
Right.
That these anti-Nicene fathers, you could search their works. I've done it. You do not find the phrase Christian priest.
Right.
It does not exist.
Uh-huh.
But if you search the Nicene and the post-Nicene fathers, you will find the phrase Christian priest
right.
very often. And I sincerely believe that when Christianity was legitimized, when it was tolerated, which is all that happened under Constantine, right?
Right.
There were pagan emperors after Constantine, but they tolerated Christianity.
Right.
The persecution stopped. But Christianity didn't become the official religion of the empire until a couple hundred years later, or it may have been not quite 200 years later, the name slipped on me,
uh-huh.
Theodosius II or something like that.
Okay.
Theodosius. Well, anyway, the priesthood, once Christianity became legitimate, these priests started setting themselves up
right.
as Christian priests.
Yes.
That they had, you know, this ages-old vocation and conductance of rituals, which allowed them to rule over people and make themselves comfortable living.
Right.
Well, they didn't want to stop that. 100,000 priests or maybe a million priests spread throughout this empire that have been lording it over the people for all this time as pagans, well, they just simply changed the name on the front of their temple.
Right.
That they changed it from the Temple of Apollo to St. Mary's. And
yeah.
All the practices stayed the same. Comparate always liked to say, and he was exactly right, that Christianity, that the legitimization of or the acceptance of Christianity under an organized church, it didn't paganize the Christian. It didn't Christianize the pagans. It paganized the Christians.
Right.
And that's exactly right.
Yes. I can see all the unemployed priests lining up for government jobs, right?
Well, they changed the names on their temples and they became Christian temples.
Right. As long as the government stipend for priests wasn't eliminated, right?
Basically, the water baptism ritual, what was a German name fastening ceremony.
Okay.
That they couldn't get the pagan Germans trying to convert to Christianity. They couldn't get them to stop doing. So the Catholic Church continued it, and they just called it baptism.
Uh-huh.
Oh, this is baptism now. That's all. And it was basically the name fastening ritual. It is, you could read about this ritual. It's repeated in the edicts,
yeah.
in the pagan edicts. It's very clear. They pour water on a child's head and sort of metaphorically stick the child's name to its head.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Okay.
And that's the same thing we do with the ship, right? But we smash a bottle on its hull and christen it. Right, right. Well, that's the same exact thing. And these pagans did it to their children. They christened them. They didn't call it that, but the church adopted the pagan ritual, started calling it christening, and then the Catholics said, oh, that's baptism.
Right. Okay.
They're Christians now. Well, my tail.
Don't they baptize dogs and cats, too?
and that's all these pets. I'd like to talk for a minute before you get to Willie Martin, if you don't mind.
Yeah,
I can do it later. But Bacchanalia, what was the winter solstice festival for the Greeks? And it was basically a drunken orgy. And the women went into the forest, hoping that Dionysius would descend from heaven and cohabit with them. And I wonder how many women were taken advantage of by Greek pagan priests playing Dionysius, right?
Right.
Now men, the men of the community understood that men weren't allowed up in the mountains and in the forests during the Bacchanalia at night. But I'm sure that many men probably got the opportunity to play the role of Dionysius with somebody else's wife. It's very evident from the writings and the tragic poets and other Greek works, literary works. Now, the Romans had a very similar drunken orgiastic festival at the same time of year called Saturnalia. And Saturnalia is basically a drunken orgy of festivals that lasted 7 days that celebrated the sun god and the years starting to be – the days started to become longer, right, instead of shorter. And one of the customs at Saturnalia was that every man in Rome had a patron, and the patron would leave his door unlocked at night, and every man would deliver a gift to his patron's house and leave it by his mantle. Well, that's where we get the
right, the Santa Claus,
the gift giving by the fireplace.
Right,
that's exactly what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd leave these gifts by the mantle or by the hearth of the patron, and they would leave.
Yeah,
and that's the whole gift giving idea of Christmas. Comes right from that Roman Saturnalia.
Right.
I don't care what you want to say about Saint Nick in Turkey in the 9th century or whatever, but this is a custom that's been around at Rome for thousands of years.
Right.
And there's nothing new under the sun.
Yes.
Now we have the gift giving on one end of the holiday and the drunken orgy at New Year's on the other end of the holiday.
Right.
But it's still a 7-day pagan festival any way you want to look at it.
Right. Yeah. It's total perversion. Right. And it's called Christian. It's amazing. The symbol, certainly Easter, has absolutely no Christian symbolism whatsoever.
You know? Well, no, it's all about fertility and,
yeah,
and sex.
Right.
But the Christian, yeah, you know, I have mixed emotions about Christmas because we're want to defend it because the Jews are always attacking it, right?
Right.
And the other races are always attacking it. And we feel this need to defend Western culture and society, and that's natural since we identify ourselves with our white kinsmen who are still lost, right?
Uh-huh.
And I usually tell people that, yeah, you know, with Christmas, and for many families it is the only time of the year they get together, and if your identity and you understand what it's all about, that's great. But you should probably, if you have the opportunity, gather with your family and you have the opportunity to set a better example. But that doesn't mean that we have to participate in what basically is a Jewish merchant holiday is what it's become.
Yes, yes, absolutely. No doubt about that. Okay. Continuing here with Willie Martin, and I think he makes one of the points that you just made, but I'll start with that sentence that I interrupted here. A study into this shows how far apostate church leaders went in their efforts to merge Christianity and paganism into one apostate religion, even to the placing the birth of the Lord Jesus Christ on a date to harmonize with the pagan birthday celebration of a so-called sun god. Yeah, that's exactly what they did.
Exactly. And in reality, Christ was probably born on the Feast of Trumpets and if not exactly on the Feast of Trumpets, definitely at that time of the year.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to be brazen enough to assert he was born on the Feast of Trumpets, even though I believe he was, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I can't prove it.
Yeah.
But it was definitely very late September or the opening days of October in 2 or 3 B.C., right? I mean, I don't have my notes with me in that instance. But
right.
He definitely wasn't born in December.
Right. Well, the gospel says that the shepherds were still out in the fields with their flocks. And in December, they're already pulled in, and they're in their, you know, corrals and in their stables. They're not out in the, you know, they're not out in the fields in December. Even, you know, it doesn't get all that cold in the Middle East, but it's cold enough.
Well, right, but for shepherds that don't have artificial means of keeping warm,
right,
and the technology that we have today, it could get awfully uncomfortable.
Right, and down jackets, et cetera. Right. It was in the 5th century that the Roman Catholic Church commanded that the birth of Christ be observed forever on December 25th, the day of the old Roman feast of the birth of Saul, one of the names of the sun god. And then it quotes that from Encyclopedia Americana, Volume 6, page 623. In pagan days, this birth of the sun god was especially popular among the branch of the mysteries known as Mithraism. Concerning this, we read, quote, "The largest pagan religious cult which fostered the celebration of December 25th as a holiday throughout the Roman and Greek worlds was the pagan sun worship Mithraism. This winter festival was called the Nativity and the Nativity of the Sun, the Golden Bough." And not only was, that's quoted from the Golden Bough. "And not only was Mithra, the sun god of Mithraism, said to be born at this time of the year, but Osiris, Horus, Hercules, Bacchus, Adonis, Jupiter, Tammuz, and other sun gods were also supposedly born on what is today called the Christmas season, the winter solstice." Says a noted writer, quote, "The winter solstice was the time at which all the sun gods from Osiris to Jupiter and Mithra had celebrated their birthdays, the celebration being adorned with the pine tree of Adonis, the holly of Saturn, and the mistletoe. Tappers represented the kindling of the newborn sun god's fire, man and his gods." So we see all of these traditions go all the way back to Mithraism.
Well, right. I wouldn't admit that Martin is being 100% accurate here, but
yes,
but it's very close.
Yes.
And I believe that that's, and we discussed it a couple of weeks ago, that even the earliest Egyptians depicted the sun, the high god, as a sun. And it was, you know, Christ says that he's the morning, bright and morning star and the light of the world. And in other words, he is the true light from the beginning. And I think that making the association with God, the creator, and the sun as a representation probably started out with good intentions and
sure
turned bad real quick.
Right. Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, you know, that's what I would think.
Isn't it the case that our people, whenever we adopt pagan rituals, they take over the rituals that Yahweh had created just for us?
Well,
right?
All the time.
It always happens. Yes.
All the time. And one other problem I have with Willie Martin is Tammuz.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of people give this Tammuz and the virgin birth and this way too much credit.
Okay.
Way more credit than it deserves. If you look at the earliest, all of the early inscriptions, and when I say early, I mean before the times of the Hebrew prophets, before the New Testament period, Tammuz is a minor god
mm-hmm.
who was a consort of Ishtar at one point.
Right.
And she basically banished him to hell, right?
Yeah.
Well, the whole Tammuz virgin birth thing, that all came in the post-Christian period.
Mm-hmm.
There is no early evidence that I've ever seen for any of those stories, and actually I've seen quite the contrary,
yeah.
because I got books of Assyrian inscriptions, and Tammuz has none of those qualities.
So the legend of Tammuz was made bigger and bigger as time went on, in other words.
Well it made bigger. I think they used
embellished.
It to compensate for the Christianity story, right?
Right, okay.
That the pagans of Mesopotamia embellished the story to make it more Christian, just like the Krishna story doesn't have the antiquity that people claim for it. The
right.
Krishna story is just a copy of the gospel story
yes.
that was corrupted for those Manzars in India.
Yes. Anyway, speaking about this Christmas tree business here in Jeremiah 10, he goes on to say, this idea spread and developed so that the various nations all have had their legends about sacred trees. Among the Druids, the oak was sacred. Among the Egyptians, it was the palm. And in Rome, it was the fir, which was decorated with red berries during the Saturnalia. And this is from Curiosities of Popular Customs, page 242. Among the Scandinavians, the fir tree was sacred to their god Odin. The Scandinavian god Woden, or Odin, was believed to bestow special gifts at Yuletide to those who honored him by approaching this sacred fir tree. Festivals, Holy Days, and Saints Days, page 22. And even as other rites of the Yuletide season were absorbed into Christianity, so also is the widespread use of the tree at this season a carryover of an ancient practice. The Christmas tree recapitulates the idea of tree worship, gilded nuts and balls symbolizing the sun. All of the festivities of the pagan winter solstice have been absorbed into Christmas Day. The use of holly and mistletoe in the druidic ceremonies, the Christmas tree to the honors paid to Odin's sacred fir, also quoted from festivals, holy days, and saints' days. So I don't think we need to belabor the point. Christmas is not a Christian holiday. It's a pagan holiday that's been Christianized over the centuries, okay? And it was basically the Catholic Church that began this practice.
Right, exactly. And I'd like to, because we're on this holiday feast, right, theme tonight, I'd like to talk about Hanukkah for a minute, right? Because there's a little discussion over in the chat room. Some people think Hanukkah is biblical. Hanukkah is only quasi-biblical. It is not a covenant feast, period. Yahweh never decreed Hanukkah, period. It's mentioned once in the Restoration when Christ in the Gospel of John, I think it might be chapter 12, but I'm really not sure. In the Gospel of John, Christ is in the temple for the Feast of the Restoration. The Feast of the Restoration is, that word is from, you know, translated from the word that the Jews today call Hanukkah. And it's actually a feast, and that doesn't mean Christ celebrated it just because he was in the temple. It's immaterial whether Christ celebrated it or not. That the feast was decreed by the Maccabees as a celebration because it was the dedication, the rededication of the temple after it had been ruined by the Seleucids, right? In 155, 156 BC, the Seleucids destroyed the temple. They didn't tear it down, but they wrecked it, and
mm-hmm.
they sacrificed a pig on the altar.
Right.
And it took the Maccabees about 3 years to get the temple fixed back up.
Right.
So that they decreed the celebration of Hanukkah in what, which means restoration,
uh-huh.
in the as a dedication of the reopening of the temple after that period.
Right.
And that's all it is, but it's not a covenant feast. It's not a feast of Yahweh, and Christians probably should be apathetic towards it because
right.
the true temple is our bodies, the vessel for the Spirit of God.
Right.
We
right.
don't celebrate a feast in honor of a damned pile of bricks.
Right.
Period.
Yeah, right. Well, certainly the Judahites under the Maccabees felt correct in celebrating that, the fact that they had cleansed the temple and gotten rid of the Greeks, okay? And so they were just celebrating that fact, right? And that is correct. It was a restoration of Judah taking control of the city of Jerusalem away from the Greeks at that time. So, okay, so here we go, verse 9. Let me find the troll here and blew him off. There we go. Okay, verse 9. Silver spread into plates is brought from Tarshish, and gold from Uphaz, the work of the workmen and of the hands of the founder. Blue and purple is their clothing. They're all the work of cunning men.
Well, that's,
yeah.
you know, like silver bells and so
right.
I keep Bing Crosby's singing
right.
now, right?
right?
But we're still on the same subject. I just had to throw that in.
Right. And Tarshish would be Spain, right?
Yes, Tarshish is Spain.
Okay.
Uphaz is probably on the east coast of Africa, would be my guess off the top of my head.
Okay.
I don't know if it's identifiable.
Right. And, of course, this is one of the outposts of the Phoenician Israelites. You know, Spain, you know, they had numerous outposts in Spain, of course, as far north as Ireland and certainly Cornwall in England, where they got their tin, right? Verse 10.
Right. Now, let me just say, Uphaz, I would identify it with Ophir.
Okay.
But that's, and that could, it could
that
possibly, it, it could be a scribal error for Ophir, now that I'm looking at the Hebrew, where the resh became a, it's possible, where the resh became a sadi, which is that TS letter. This could be a Masoretic error. And it's Uphaz only appears twice. The place is not identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
But Ophir is the Latin Afer, and that's where Africa got its name from.
Okay.
And,
yes.
and the east coast of Africa was a source of gold for the Israelites.
Yes, yes. Okay, very good. All right, verse 10. But Yahweh is the true God. He is the living God and an everlasting king. At his wrath the earth shall tremble, and the nations shall not be able to abide his indignation. Okay, we have, again, this is a direct reference to the judgment day. We've had a couple of oblique ones, but this is one that's direct. Yes.
This is important, and I believe that this has a lot of application today.
Yeah.
Because today we have this whole Christian cult of the Christmas tree, right? And it's not the Christmas tree that's really at fault. It's an idol. It's a useless idol. It can't do
yes.
good. It can't do evil, like we were just told. But it's everything that's grown up around Christmas. This great Jewish merchant holiday, which has become a holiday of I want and
yes.
greed, right?
Yes.
And more people kill themselves at Christmas time than any other
oh, yeah.
time of the year. And,
yes.
and people go into thousands and thousands of dollars worth of debt every year to
mm-hmm.
satisfy their lust, their greed, and their desire to be big shots, you know, at Christmas.
Yeah,
time. And,
right.
and that's, it's basically the Jew and the enemies of God are enriched every year at Christmas time by all these fools that go out and get into debt over this pagan festival.
Right.
And,
right.
and here we see this whole picture of what we consider Christmas, you know, the worship of this tree, and I believe that there's a direct connection there. And here Yahweh asserts he is the true God. He is the living God. And there will be a day of wrath and indignation. I think that this has important, this whole prophecy has important application to this.
Right. And it's becoming traditional at the Feast of Thanksgiving, when you know the day after Thanksgiving, when they open the doors for the shoppers, for shoppers to get trampled to death when they open the doors, right? That's real Christmas spirit, right? Okay, verse 11. Thus shall you say to them, the gods that have not made the heavens and the earth, even they shall perish from the earth and from under these heavens. He has made the earth by his power. He has established the world by his wisdom and has stretched out the heavens by his discretion. When he utters his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens, and he causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He makes lightnings with rain and brings forth the wind out of the treasures. Every man is brutish in his knowledge. Every founder is confounded by the graven image, for his molten image is falsehood, and there is no breath in them. They are vanity and the work of errors. In the time of their visitation they shall perish. The portion of Jacob is not like them, for he is the former of all things, and Israel is the rod of his inheritance. Oh, I love that line.
And I have to clarify, read the end of it, but I have to clarify the beginning of it.
Yahweh of hosts is his name.
Now, let me say, the portion of Jacob is not like him, for he is the former. That word former here is not former meaning past, okay? It's former meaning a maker or a creator, the one who forms, right? That,
right.
And that
the
could
molder.
Be very easily misinterpreted here.
Right, right, yes.
Well, we have another troll in another
name. Yeah, it's Lindstedt coming back under different names. So I have to kick
Well, yeah, this is not, Jacob is not the former of all things, right?
Right.
It's talking about the portion of Jacob is not like them, and he is Yahweh, for he, Yahweh, is the creator of all things. Yahweh is the portion of Jacob, the God of Jacob, as opposed to the God of the gods with a small g of the heathen nations, of the pagan nations.
Yes. Okay, very good. Verse 17, gather up your wares out of the land, O inhabitant of the fortress. For thus says Yahweh, behold, I will sling out the inhabitants of the land at this once and will distress them that they may find it so. Woe is me for my hurt. My wound is grievous, but I said, truly, this is a grief, and I must bear it. These words must be those of Jeremiah. My tabernacle is spoiled, and all my cords are broken. My children are gone forth of me, and they are not. There is none to stretch forth my tent anymore and to set up my curtains.
Well, I think these are probably the words of Yahweh, and Yahweh is saying that he's hurt.
Okay.
Because his wife, he's had to put away his wife, right?
Yeah, very good.
And his tabernacle is spoiled. That's the body of the nation and the people of Israel.
Right. And verse 21 confirms that, for the pastors are become brutish, and they have not sought Yahweh. Therefore they shall not prosper, and all their flocks shall be scattered. Again, we're told 100 times in the Old Testament, And several times in the New Testament as well, that our prosperity is dependent on our obedience to Yahweh. It's just that simple. Verse 22, behold, the noise of the brute is come, and a great commotion out of the north country to make the cities of Judah desolate, and a den of dragons. Of course, that means Edomite Jews have crept in. Verse 23, O Yahweh, I know that the way of the man is not in himself. It is not in man that walks to direct his steps. O Yahweh, correct me, but with judgment, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. Pour out your fury upon the heathen that know you not, and upon the families that call not on your name, for they have eaten up Jacob, and devoured him, and consumed him, and have made his habitation desolate. Okay, any final comments on chapter 10?
Well, where it talks about these other nations, these other families, and these people that didn't know his name, we can never lose sight of the fact that Yahweh didn't choose Israel as being the white race versus the other races of the earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh didn't, the other races of the earth didn't descend from Adam,
right.
And Yahweh really doesn't have them in the scope of the Bible, the Old Testament, at all.
Right.
And what we have here is we have Yahweh choosing Israel and Abraham in particular and his descendants through Israel alone as being the family of Genesis 10 that's going to carry on his will in the earth,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to all of the other white families. And Paul talks about all these other white families in Acts chapter 17, and I'd like to quote that to get that point across here, and I'm going to paraphrase it, and has made of one blood all nations of Adam, or Adamic man.
Right.
And that's a reference to Deuteronomy 32:8, right, which says that Yahweh separated the sons of Adam, and when he did so, he left the bounds of the people according to the number of children of Israel.
Right.
Well, Paul says that he made of one blood all the nations of Adamic man to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek Yahweh, if haply they might, that they might search after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us.
Right.
And there's other, there's another place in the gospel where in Paul's letters where he tells explicitly that every nation was allowed to go their own way. They all went off into pagan idolatry, and Yahweh chose Abraham, and that was his will to do that. And he chose Abraham alone out of all these other white nations. That, that's just the way it is. So he basically cast aside the rest of the white nations. Now, Christ tells us very clearly in Luke chapter 11 and in Matthew that the other white nations will be in the resurrection.
Right.
Where he tells the Judeans that the men of Nineveh, which are the Asherites, right, the tribe of Asher, the men of Nineveh will rise in the resurrection and condemn this race.
Right.
That meaning the Jews or the Edomite Judeans.
Mm-hmm.
And that the queen of the south, who's actually of Sheba, and she was white.
Yes, she was.
She would arise in the resurrection and condemn this race. So the other Adamic white people aren't to be despised. They just weren't that chosen line. And as Paul explains, they all went off into their own pagan idolatry, because Yahweh let them go their own way to see which nations would follow after him.
Right.
Now Abraham was chosen because he was one of the few, as we're told in Genesis chapter 25, who kept Yahweh's statutes, laws,
right,
and judgments.
Right. Yes.
Abraham was chosen because he kept the law.
Right. Now, isn't that verse that you quoted from Paul where it says one blood, isn't that word blood added?
Well, right. The word blood was actually added to the text. It doesn't belong there. I was paraphrasing from the King James
right,
in front of me.
Right.
But it's he made of one all nations, and that's a reference to Deuteronomy 32:8 and to the Genesis accounts of the creation of Adam and the descendants of the race of Adam through Noah. It only counts the white races. You can't get anybody else into that equation.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
don't fit. They don't fit in the Bible, and they don't fit in history.
Yeah, and it's also, I'd say, a paraphrase of Genesis 6, where it says, Japheth shall dwell in the tents of Shem.
Well, right. That's related.
Yes.
You know that an end was going to come to the Hamite nations.
Right.
And then the end did come to the Hamite nations. I mean, I doubt if there are many of us who are descended from Ham, or if we have Hamitic blood in us,
right,
it's probably a very, very small portion.
Right.
Because the Egyptians were in Europe, and there's no doubt about that. And the Cushites were in Mesopotamia, and there's no doubt about that.
Yes.
But the Hamitic nations came to an end and were all eventually overrun by the dark races.
Yes. And it is simply a fact of history that the European nation states and even the Middle Eastern nation states were formed by the descendants of Shem through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, right? Even though Japhethites may have occupied those territories before the Israelites arrived, the nations we have today were all created by the Israelites.
Well, yes, by the Germanic and Celtic people who all descended from the Israelites, and they themselves were only a small part of the white race, and there were no Germans or no Celts in the time of Abraham.
Right.
There were Japhethites in lands that were later occupied by Celts. There's no doubt about that. But they weren't Celts. That doesn't make them Celts.
Mm-hmm.
We too easily, as a people, are fooled by the Jew into putting a relationship with forebears and predecessors, right?
Uh-huh.
Your predecessors are not necessarily your forebears. Yeah, you know, and because we have white predecessors in any particular land doesn't make them our ancestors.
Right.
In other words, there were whites in England before the Britons, the Phoenicians, and the Saxons got there. And we have a history of Japhethites in Europe for 2,500 years. It's 2,500 years from the time of the Genesis 10 and 11 events, yet, you know, the flood and the dispersion of the descendants of Noah. There's 2,500 years between that time and the time of the first writing found in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
The first historical accounts of the Greeks really don't come until Homer, and that's over 2,500 years later. So we've had Japhethites and other Shemites and other people wandering and settling diverse places in Europe, the Ionians and the Etruscans, the Lydians, and other peoples, and no written history.
Right. Right.
Zero. Homer is brand spanking new compared to Moses,
yeah,
and compared to the inscriptions of Mesopotamia, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh and writing like that. I mean, Homer is 600 BC, and that's it can be established that that's about when he wrote, and 600 BC. Isaiah already long finished writing. That's the time Jeremiah right here is 627 BC. He starts writing.
Yeah. And it's also quite amazing that all of these Greek and Hebrew authors, you know, writing all these documents that we still have available today, and yet during the reign of the Catholic Church, during the feudalistic system, literacy was virtually annihilated. Right? What happened to writing? It just disappeared. It's quite amazing. Quite amazing. Okay, let me back up to verse 4 because it sets up verse 5.
Well, I have one problematic one problematic verse in my notes that I passed over. In 10:22, it says the noise of the brute, and that should be translated the sound of the report, right?
Oh,
I mean, it's a horrible translation. It's the sound of the report has come. It's not the noise of the brute, as we see a brute to be a beast or anything like that.
Right.
It's the sound of the report when you check the Hebrew.
Right, and that would be the report of a weapon? Is that what it means?
Well, yeah, a report that Jerusalem's going to be invaded, right?
Yeah, yeah.
By the Babylonians, what that's referring to. But it doesn't happen for another practically 40 years.
Uh-huh.
And that shows you know, that Yahweh's time clock just isn't ours, and I have notes on that later, I think.
Yeah, okay. All right, now let me back up to verse 4 of chapter 11, because it sets up verse 5 here, which I commanded your fathers in the day that I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, from the iron furnace, saying, obey my voice and do them according to all which I command you, so shall you be my people, and I will be your God. He is simply declaring here that we Israelites are defined as his people who obey his word. Verse 5, that I may perform the oath, and we exclusively have been commissioned for these commandments and statutes and judgments, that I may perform the oath which I have sworn to your fathers, to give them a land flowing with milk and honey as it is this day. Then answered I and said, so be it, Yahweh. And, of course, he is simply reaffirming that he, Yahweh, has done all these things for us, and we don't appreciate it. Verse 6.
Well, I have some notes on this here. You know, this verse 4, I commanded your fathers in the day that I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt. Our parents agreed as a people to obedience, to do these things. In Exodus chapter 19, right? They agreed explicitly. We will obey the law.
Right.
We will do these things. And they bound their posterity to that agreement. And we are that posterity.
That's right.
And many people today might think, well, that's unfair. But it's a fact of our history, and we are a product of our ancestors, and we basically have to respect their pledges.
Mm-hmm.
It's our inheritance that they left to us.
Right.
And it's always framed in the Bible by that term, heritage, inheritance. And whether we like it or not, we owe our very existence to our parents.
Mm-hmm.
So they
right.
have a right to pledge that on our behalf.
Yes.
And we don't really have a say in the matter. We have to go along with it. We owe our very existence to them, and we owe our very existence to our God, and therefore we owe our God our allegiance.
Right.
And there is an entire list of very explicit curses which are pronounced from Deuteronomy 27:15 through 27:26 against all who would break the certain aspects of that covenant.
Uh-huh.
And we're living those curses now.
Right.
That's why the aliens have grown and vaunted themselves over us in our own land. That's why the Jews own everything in our own land.
Mm-hmm.
It's our own disobedience. It's done it, and it's happening. It happened in ancient Jerusalem, and it's happening again today.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and in addition to the curses for disobeying the law, we still stand to gain the inheritance, which is a glorious thing, and our people have simply thrown it away. They've thrown it away, and this is a national message. It's to our race, and the modern churches have totally ignored the national message and have substituted for it this ridiculous gospel of personal salvation. That the only thing that Christianity is about is my relationship with my definition of Jesus, right? and that's what religion has become. It has no connection to the Bible whatsoever. It's a foreign religion.
Well, Lynn Stench has had it again in the chat room.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
I had to reboot my computer froze, so I'll get back there shortly. All right, verse 6. Then Yahweh said to me, proclaim all these words in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, saying, hear you the words of this covenant and do them. For I earnestly protested to your fathers in the day that I brought them up out of the land of Egypt, even to this day, rising early and protesting, saying, obey my voice. Yet they obeyed not, nor inclined their ear, but walked every one in the imagination of their evil heart. Therefore will I bring upon them all the words of this covenant, which I commanded them to do, but they did them not. Okay, and of course that's the curses if we disobey and the blessings if we obey. Verse 9, and Yahweh said to me, a conspiracy is found among the men of Judah and among the inhabitants of Jerusalem. It says conspiracy there, folks. That's the actual word in the King James. They are turned back to the iniquities of their forefathers, which refused to hear my words, and they went after other gods to serve them. And the house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant, which I made with their fathers. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, behold, I will bring evil upon them, which they shall not be able to escape. And though they shall cry to me, I will not hearken to them. Then shall the cities of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem go and cry to their gods to whom they offer incense, but they shall not save them at all in the time of their trouble. For according to the number of your cities were your gods, O Judah, and according to the number of the streets of Jerusalem have you set up altars to that shameful thing, even altars to burn incense, to Baal. Therefore, pray not you for this people, neither lift up a cry or prayer for them, for I will not hear them in the time that they cry to me for their trouble. Here we have Yahweh again saying, he does not listen to rebellious sinners. He just doesn't do it. And the churches all teach that, well, it doesn't matter if you're a sinner or not. You pray to God, and you know he's going to answer your prayer. That's hogwash. It's just not true. What has my beloved to do in my house, seeing she has wrought lewdness with many, and the holy flesh is passed from you? When you do evil, when you rejoice, what is this, the holy flesh is passed
well,
from
you? Well, the only way the holy flesh can pass from you is if you race mix.
That's right.
Period.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw race mixing was one of the major indictments against Judah. Right in Jeremiah chapter 2, that's the way the prophecy opened. What was a very lengthy admonishment for race mixing.
Right.
Well, which is what Jeremiah chapter 2 is.
Yes, very good. And verse 16, Yahweh Yahweh called your name a green olive tree, fair and of goodly fruit. With the noise of a great tumult, he has kindled fire upon it, and the branches of it are broken. Now, here's one of these symbols of Israel, right? The olive tree.
Yes, absolutely.
Which comes...
And several times.
Right. And which comes to be very important in the book of Revelation. And somehow the Judeo-Christian ministers can't figure out what this olive tree is.
Well, that's because they're New Testament Christians.
Right.
They want to make up what those symbols mean.
Right.
They don't want to look to the Old Testament to see what they mean.
Yes, yes. Okay, very good. Verse 17, for Yahweh of hosts that planted you has pronounced evil against you, for the evil of the house of Israel, the house of Judah, which they have done against themselves to provoke me to anger and offering incense to Baal. Now here he's saying he gets angry. This is foreign to modern Judeo-Christianity too. They say that God doesn't get angry. It's just love, 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 love. Right?
And right, exactly. And another thing we see, and this will, you know, fools like troublemaker are exposed every time we read the scripture, right?
Yeah.
But we see here that Israel and Judah both sinned, so they were both under the law. They were both equally bound to the covenant, and they were both equally married to Yahweh, and therefore they are both being equally put off or divorced.
Yeah.
Right? There's no Judah never receives any treatment any differently than Israel does.
Right, right. Very good. Verse 18, and Yahweh has given me knowledge of it, and I know it. Then you showed me their doings. But I was like a lamb or an ox that is brought to the slaughter, and I knew not that they had devised devices against me, saying, let us destroy the tree with the fruit thereof. We're talking about the olive tree. And let us cut him off, not the Christmas tree, and let us cut him off from the land of the living, that his name may be no more remembered. This is a very important verse. Let me read it again. I have to turn it back here. Verse 19, but I was like a lamb or an ox that is brought to the slaughter, and I knew not that they had devised devices against me. We're talking about, who is the conspirator against Judah and Israel? It's the Edomites.
No, this is talking about Jeremiah. This is Jeremiah talking here.
Okay.
And he was told to go pronounce these sins against Judah.
Right.
And they want to kill him is what's going on here. Here Jeremiah illustrates the hate that our people have for those of their own who point out their sins to them. And if you ever want to feel that hatred, I felt it. Walk into a room full of white guys that are watching a football game and ask them, why are you worshiping those Negroes? Ask them that. And you'll feel that exact hate that Jeremiah must have felt 2,600 years ago. That even though historically we see that wherever it was recorded in the Old Testament, it was the Canaanite who was behind the actual slaying of the prophets. And yet in these times, our people had the same attitude.
Yeah.
And it's the same Canaanite, the Jewish panderers, who are still behind the leading of our people into sin.
Mm-hmm.
When you point out their sin, they hate you and they want to kill you.
Right.
And this is what Jeremiah is talking about here, that Yahweh had him go talk to these people, and he was like a lamb or an ox that is brought to the slaughter.
Well, it's certainly the case that Yahweh's prophets always accused the Israelites to their face for their wrongdoing. And that is why we in Identity are hated by the Judeo-Christians, because we're doing the same thing, right? We're playing the part of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, etc., etc., because they ignore those prophets. Verse 20. Actually, I didn't finish verse 19. And let us cut him off from the land of the living, that his name may be no more remembered. See, the Christians, the Judeo-Christians, do not want to remember the message that the prophets bring. They simply don't want to hear it. Verse 20, but, O Yahweh of hosts, that judges righteously, that tries the reins and the heart, let me see your vengeance on them, for to you have I revealed my cause. Now, this word reins, is that another euphemism for the gut, the reins and the heart? Because sometimes this affections, right?
Well, right, and I'm looking for it right now. Yes. I looked up some problematic Hebrew words before.
Right, and I remember we've run across this one before where
it's actually literally the kidneys, right?
Kidneys. Oh,
now
kidneys.
The Greek word is splanchnon, right?
Uh-huh.
The splanchnon, in the ancient world, the heart was what was seen as the seat of the soul and the mind and the thought. They didn't really understand the function of the brain, right? And the guts, the kidneys, the splanchnon basically means the intestines in Greek, the bowels. And that was used to represent the seat of emotions, okay? So here we have the reins and the heart. The heart is the seat of the soul or the mind. And we still consider it that way today, right? Even though we understand the function of the brain. Yeah, you know, when we talk about a man's heart, we really talk about his mind and his will. And the kidneys are and a metaphor for the seat of passions and emotions and feelings.
Yes. Okay, very good.
And for some reason they translated it rain.
Yeah.
Don't ask me why.
That just loses the entire meaning.
Right. But literally it's kidneys, but it was seen as the seat of passions, emotions and that would be the equivalent of bowels in the Greek New Testament.
Yeah,
well,
okay.
It's literally bowels, but it's splanchnon, and I translate it passion most often.
Yes, very good, very good. Okay, verse 21. Therefore, thus says Yahweh of the men of Anatoth that seek your life, saying, prophesy not in the name of Yahweh that you die not by our hand. Therefore, thus says Yahweh of hosts, behold, I will punish them. The young man shall die by the sword, their sons and their daughters shall die by famine, and there shall be no remnant of them, for I will bring evil upon the men of Anatoth, even the year of their visitation.
Now in Jeremiah chapter 32, Jeremiah purchases a field in Anatoth, right?
Yeah.
Anatoth was a city of Benjamin, and it was designated as a Levitical city of refuge and one of the 13 cities for the descendants of Aaron specifically, and that's in Joshua chapter 21. And there's not a whole lot in the New Testament other than that about Anatoth, except that in Isaiah 10, chapter 10, verse 30, it says that Anatoth is described as poor or afflicted. And even there, we're not told precisely why, but Jeremiah describes Anatoth as afflicted. If it's a Levitical city of refuge, and that's a seat of judgment for that district, right? I would think it was probably afflicted because it was probably infiltrated by the enemy, as our halls of justice are the first target of the enemy in every case in Western nations even today. Where have they infiltrated? The banks in New York, the media, and Washington, right?
Right, right. Okay, very good. Well, let's see. Where did I leave off here? 22? Let me read 22 and 23. Therefore, thus says Yahweh of hosts, behold, I will punish them. The young man shall die by the sword. Their sons and their daughters shall die by famine. And there shall be no remnant of them, certainly not in Jerusalem at that time. For I will bring evil upon the men of Anatoth, even the year of their visitation. Okay. So, chapter 12, we have about 10 minutes left. We can get a few verses here. Verse 1, righteous are you, O Yahweh, when I plead with you, yet let me talk with you of your judgments. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are all they happy that deal very treacherously? You have planted them, yea, they have taken root, they grow, yea, they bring forth fruit. You are near in their mouth and far from their, again, kidneys?
Well, their passions.
Yeah, their passions.
Yeah, you know, the Jews, the enemies of God, are the most pious-looking bastards in history, right?
Yeah, right.
They don't care one bit about God, but they'll stand and recite the prayers that they have to recite with their fingers crossed behind their backs, right? That they have that. The Pharisees were always chastised by Christ for appearing to be pious and righteous,
right?
Yet their hearts were far from him. It's
right.
The same story all over again.
Yes, very good. Verse 3, but you, O Yahweh, know me. You have seen me and tried my heart toward you. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter. Amen to that.
Jeremiah is talking about the wicked.
That's
and,
right.
And why do they prosper? And we ask those same questions today.
Right. Well,
why do these wicked, evil people, with their billions of dollars and their designs to destroy the white race and destroy the planet, why do they seem to do so well?
Yeah, because
why
our people,
do they prosper?
Yeah, our people facilitate their progress, right?
And Jeremiah prayed for their destruction,
mm-hmm.
just like we pray today.
That's right.
For their destruction.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Verse 4. How long shall a land mourn and the herbs of every field wither for the wickedness of them that dwell therein? The beasts are consumed and the birds because they said, he shall not see our last end. If you have run with the footmen and they have wearied you, then how can you contend with horses? And if in the land of peace wherein you trusted they wearied you, then how will you do in the swelling of Jordan? For even your brethren and the house of your father, even they have dealt treacherously with you. Yea, they have called a multitude after you. Believe them not, though they speak fair words to you. In other words, the people of Judah became morally bankrupt, probably because obviously they were following Edomite traditions that always seem to creep into our people. Verse 7. I have forsaken my house, I have left my heritage, I have given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies.
Now that describes to me when Ezekiel recorded that he saw the essence of Yahweh depart from the temple, right?
Yes.
In the opening chapter, and I believe that that's what this is referring to also,
uh-huh.
even though it didn't quite happen yet, because Ezekiel didn't start writing for another 20 years after Jeremiah,
uh-huh.
basically, maybe even a little longer. But that this is basically, he's making the statement now and as if it happened, but it's only about to happen.
Yes.
But this is what he means. He's given, once his essence leaves the temple, he's basically given the nation up to be taken by the Babylonians, by the enemy.
Yes, very good. Okay, verse 7. I have forsaken my house, I have left my heritage, I have given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies. My heritage is to me as a lion in the forest, it cries out against me, therefore I have hated it. My heritage is to me as a speckled bird.
Yeah, a lot of black dots, right?
Right, right, right.
Just
birds,
like today.
Yeah, exactly. The birds round about are against her. Come you, assemble all the beasts of the field, come to devour. Many pastors have destroyed my vineyard. They have trodden my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness.
John Hagee.
Yes, they have made it desolate, and being desolate it mourns to me. The whole land is made desolate because no man lays it to heart.
And false pastors are why the bird is speckled, right?
Right. Absolutely. And there's no shortage of them today either. Verse 12. The spoilers are come upon all high places through the wilderness. For the sword of Yahweh shall devour from the one end of the land even to the other end. No flesh shall have peace. They have sown wheat, but shall reap thorns. They have put themselves to pain, but shall not profit. And they shall be ashamed of your revenues because of the fierce anger of Yahweh. Revenue, I think, meaning harvest, right? Thus says Yahweh against all my evil neighbors that touch the inheritance which I have caused my people Israel to inherit. My people Israel, folks, that never changes throughout from the beginning of Genesis 1 to the end of Revelation 22. Always, we Israelites are his people. Behold, I will pluck them out of their land and pluck out the house of Judah from among them. And it shall come to pass, after that I have plucked them out, I will return and have compassion on them and will bring them again, every man to his heritage and every man to his land. So this, finally, we're getting some good news here.
Well, this addresses the fools that say that there's no more legitimate house of Judah, right?
Right.
Because Yahweh is saying that he's going to pluck the real house of Judah, of course, out from among all of those alien peoples, the Edomites, the Canaanites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, who spoiled Judah.
Right. Very good. Verse 16, and it shall come to pass, if they will diligently learn the ways of my people to swear by my name, Yahweh lives, as they taught my people to swear by Baal, then thou shall be built in the midst of my people. But if they will not obey, I will utterly pluck up and destroy that nation, says Yahweh. Okay, so a very consistent message. If we worship Yahweh according to his will, according to his testimony, then our inheritance is assured. But if we
that's the only way we can have happiness in society. It is to, first to obey his law, and second to shun his enemies. We Christians can't embrace the Jews, right?
Right.
We can never embrace the Jews. We can never embrace sinners. We can never embrace aliens and people that deny our God.
Yes.
And if we do these things and keep his law, we will have prosperity. There is no other way that we will ever have prosperity. That is the only recipe to prosperity.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Bible is so consistent at that point. I just can't understand how any of these Judeo-Christian ministers teach anything else. It's just amazing to me. All right. Okay, so we've gotten it through chapter 12 of Jeremiah. And tomorrow we will start our discussion of the book of Revelation on Yahweh's covenant people. And I think the first segment is going to be all introductory because we have a lot of symbolic language. We just ran into one of these symbols in Jeremiah, namely the olive tree. And so we'll have a lot of symbology to talk about so that we can properly understand the symbolism of the book of Revelation. I think we'll find out, and we talked about this earlier today by phone, Bill, that virtually every word in the book of Revelation is symbolic, and there's very, very little in the book of Revelation that can be taken literally. So I think what we're going to do as we go through the book of Revelation is consciously look for sentences, for passages that can be taken literally. We'll see, we'll find out if there actually are any, So we'll find that out. So we're looking very much forward to starting the book of Revelation tomorrow, okay?
Absolutely. And,
yes.
And praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow night, and we're going to start book of Revelation. Looking forward to that. Yahweh bless everybody.